Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday. My name is Connor Collins. I am a registered massage therapist and sports injury therapist practicing 45 minutes outside of Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. And welcome to the Concast, a podcast where we discuss all things health, wellness, and injuries in an attempt to better understand the human body. This is episode 53, where I had the pleasure of interviewing Steve Farrell. Steve is a therapeutic counselor, yoga instructor, and author from Hamilton, Ontario. And during this conversation, we talked at length about mindfulness, meditation, stress, and some of the different tools, as well as some of the different hooks or triggers that can go into a stressful event. So I really do hope that you see this episode as valuable. I know that I learned a lot. So sit back, enjoy, and we will see you in the next one. Okay, good morning, everybody. Happy Friday. Connor here. I hope your morning is going well. I have another interview for you that I'm really excited to do this morning. Just based on everything that's going on in the world today, I thought it would be great to bring on my friend Steve Farrell this morning. Good morning, Steve, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, Connor, it's a pleasure to be here. I really enjoy all the things that you do, and it's good to actually be able to meet you for the first time, because we've been sort of long distance virtual friends for a couple of years now.
For sure. It's one of those beneficial things of the internet, and I'm sure that we'll meet each other very soon in person. I think I am really, really excited about today's topic, because I think that it couldn't come at a more important time. And that is the topic of kind of stress and mindfulness. And before we get into today's topic, Steve and I both want to give a bit of a disclaimer that the tools and the topics that we're going to be discussing today are not to replace any of the current healthcare providers or practitioners that you're seeing with regards to your mental health, as well as any of the current medications that you might be on. So just be mindful of that before we start today's discussion. But before we get into things, Steve, I'd love to learn a little bit more about your journey and how you got to where you're at today and some of the projects that you're working on.
Yeah, I'd love to share that. So the journey that I've been on, especially within the world that I sort of see myself in now, or the context that I'm in now, started back when I was like 17, where I basically just sat around all day and played video games and ate Doritos. And then at some point I decided that I wanted to lose a bunch of weight and get fit. So I started to lift weights with my cousin, who was sort of a bodybuilder at the time, and he really got me onto it. I would say one of the things that I loved about lifting was that it was a way for me to be physical and to get to know my body, but I was terrible at team sports. So it's like, it was nice because I could be by myself and just work on it. And it was also one of the first things I did with my body that I was actually good at. I was actually good at lifting weights. And so from there, got really into bodybuilding. I was bodybuilding from the age of about 17 or 18 till about 27, so about 10 years, which is very difficult to tell these days because I'm like 70 pounds lighter than I used to be, solid. And then, so my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, was tired of me complaining about all of the pain in my body, because back then, if you were a bodybuilder, you were just always in pain and barely mobile. So she was like, hey, you should come do a yoga class with me. So I went to my first yoga class in, I think, February of 2007-ish, 2006, 2007. And I came out of the practice and I felt something that these days I say that maybe I've felt it before, but just never recognized. But at the time, it was something that I didn't realize I'd ever felt before, which was a deeper connection, not only to my body, but also to my mind and the world around me. And I leaned over to my wife at the time and I said, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And so I did. And then I parlayed that into a teacher training program. And then I started to roll out being a yoga teacher. And I'm still a yoga teacher today, but doing it a little bit less. And then when I was teaching yoga, I started to get really into meditation practice, which then led into facilitating meditation. I'm also an author, which was a really wonderful opportunity that popped up because of the work that I do. So one of my now close friends was a student at the time, and he's got his master's in social work. And he said to me one day, he's like, "You don't know this, but the way that you teach yoga is the way that I do therapy." And I was like, "Okay, tell me about that a little bit more." And so we started to have these conversations about how mindfulness, yoga philosophy is very congruent with the modality of counseling that I do, which is acceptance and commitment therapy is the primary modality. Yeah. And then so I got to write a book, which was a really wonderful opportunity, which is called Mindful Yoga-Based Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, which is really geared towards helping mental health care practitioners bring in movement practice to their sort of clinical practice, as well as the sort of second hand of the book is to teach yoga teachers what sort of modern day cognitive behavioral sciences and concepts and theories have to offer yoga teachers. So not saying that they are therapists or counselors, but there's a lot of great information out there that I think that everybody could be on board with as far as like really tuning into mental health. And then, yeah. And then my friend eventually brought me into the counseling world, which is what I do. I'm going to say the bulk of what I do during COVID is counseling.
Amazing. And I think that I'll get some information about where people can find your book at the end of the podcast. But I think you're right. I think so much of what we can do with movement and cueing can help that. And as I've said to you before, there are two very common themes that people will say about your yoga classes, which are you are very much into things like biomechanics, anatomy, and cueing, and your classes are the hardest classes they've taken because you make them sit in poses for so long and think about what they're doing there. And I think we'll get more and more into why it's so important to think about what we're doing in today's discussion. But
yeah.
With everything going on in the world, Steve, there is a really high amount of stress and a number of emotions that people are feeling for just a host of reasons. And I would love to start off today's conversation by getting just your thoughts and philosophies on stress in general and what stress means to you, because I get this common narrative that I see a lot with patients in my clinic. When the topic of stress comes up, I'll ask them if they're stressed, and they'll often say yes, or kind of, "I don't know." And the very common response when I probe a little bit further is, as to what the cause is, they just kind of shrug their shoulders, and the scapegoat is always work. So If we could just talk about, first and foremost, how do you see stress? What does stress mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question, man. And like with most things, I'm going to say that stress has multiple meanings, even for myself. If I go more the anatomical, biomechanical sort of aspect of stress, that stress is essential. Stress is how we build and strengthen tissues. It's how we get more resilient. Even if we look at like in utero, the way that a body builds itself in a womb is via some sort of friction or stress. So stress in some ways, I think, is really, really essential. Even if we're talking about cognitive stressors, where we need a little bit of cognitive effort to maintain a sense of mental health and well-being, or even brain function, if we want to look at that, although I'm definitely not a neuroscientist. But I do like to read a lot of articles about how cognitive stressors have this capacity to really create positive adaptations in a brain, which then create positive adaptations in how we sort of move in the world. And then juxtaposing just the word stress to, I like the term stressed out, where what we're looking at there is an overload of stressors, right? Where, let's say for me, when I was a bodybuilder, I was stressed out because I was maxing my tissues all the time. I was lifting well above my capacities. And that's why I had so many injuries when I was a bodybuilder, was I was stressing my body out consistently. I wasn't getting enough rest. One of the reasons why I really loved bodybuilding was I could eat whatever I wanted to and not really gain any weight. And then I figured out later on that for my body to actually function well, I have to feed it well. Right.
And right.
So my body was essentially just breaking down because I was stressed. I was stressing it out. I was overloading it consistently. And I think that it's good to make this distinction between stress, which can be really, really beneficial, and then too much stress, or the kind of stressors that we have in our lives. Like I really like the, as far as pain and stress is concerned, like the cup analogy, and how many things are filling your cup, and how many of those things are in your control, and how many of those things are not in your control. I think consistently, we might put ourselves in a place where we're overloading our plates, where we're not sleeping enough, maybe our diet's a little bit off or way off. Maybe you got kids and kids are stressful, right? Like they add a little extra layer of stress to your life. And maybe you got a job that you're not a big fan of. When the cup consistently begins to overflow, for me, this is what I call stressing out.
Yeah, I've heard that analogy a lot. I've heard the cup. I've used shopping carts in other courses or bathtubs. And I think you're right. Trying to make that distinction between a positive stressor, which might lead to some growth and personal development, which I'm sure we'll get into, and then mm-hmm. that distress, or sometimes referred to as eustress being positive stress or distress being a negative stressor.
Yeah.
Now, let's say I'm a person that's a little bit newer to my journey and I don't even know where my cup is. It's like downstairs in the basement, in a Tupperware container wrapped up in newspaper. And I haven't really seen my cup for a bunch of years. And therefore I don't know what fills my cup, or I don't know how full my cup is. What is some of the first things that we can begin to recognize that we may be becoming stressed out, or these things might not be as positive for us as we might think?
Yeah, I think one thing to say at the beginning of this particular part of the conversation is that everybody's good stress and perceptively negative stress is going to be individual. It might even have a bit of a time constraint on it, where what used to be not stressful is now stressful, or what used to be stressful is now not so stressful. One of the things that I like to look at, especially with my clients, I like to use this term hooks, mostly because I like fishing analogies. So it really, really works for me. But the way that we might also label a hook is more of a popular term these days, which is a trigger. What's triggered you? How did you get triggered? But I like fishing more than I like guns, so I'm going to lean more towards the fishing analogies. And the way that we could describe a hook is anything that happens before a behavior, or the technical term for it would be an antecedent. An antecedent is anything that happens before any other behavior. Within this idea of hooks, hooks can be more positive or negative, right? Like a positive hook for me could be something like, I'm sitting on the couch with my family and my son looks over at me with his little, like his actually very big brown eyes. And he says to me, "Daddy, I love you so much," which would be a hook for me, a positive hook, because then my heart melts a little bit and I smile back and maybe a tear drips down my eye and then we hug each other. So his words were a positive hook for me, the behaviors that rolled out after that, the feeling that I got and then the hug that we did. A hook could be also more negative. And maybe in the realm of a direct hook, where I stub my big toe and then I scream out in pain, that would be more of a direct hook. Or maybe an indirect hook would be something like I'm scrolling through my social media feed and I see a picture of somebody who I used to be friends with, but they did me some harm in the past. And then the behavior is possibly I spend an hour and a half ruminating about all of the ways that that person hurt me and then how I want to get back at them. And so that would be the hooks. And so part of that question then with my clients is, whatever behaviors it is that are happening within your life, like maybe you're tense all the time, your body's really sore, maybe you're yelling at your kids more than you'd like, or you're having some resentful thoughts against your partner, or you really don't like your job. And then there's some days when you don't go to it because you don't like your job so much. The question then becomes for a lot of my people is, are these problematic behaviors that are rolling out? Like the behaviors that you're doing, are these things problematic for you? So if we go back to the tension of your client's shoulders and you ask them something like, is the tension in your shoulders getting in the way of you doing what you really want to do in your life? And they say no, then for me, that's not really a hook, because it's not necessarily going to lead to problematic behaviors. Whereas if you ask them like, is the tension in your shoulders getting in the way of the life that you want to live? And they say something like, yeah, I can't pick up my kids. I really love picking up my kids, or I can't do the things that I was doing. Maybe you like to do like a kettlebell snatch and then you can't do a kettlebell snatch anymore. If that becomes problematic, then I'm going to say there's a negative stressor there. There's some sort of negative stressor there that's creating a problematic behavior. But if the stress in and of itself doesn't create problematic behaviors, for me, that's more of a non-hook issue.
So really looking at the behaviors that you might be seeing as unfavorable first and seeing maybe some of the things that are preceding that might be a good place to start.
Yeah. And I think that's also a really good way to get people in contact with their cup, right? Like maybe, what do you like to do? What do you like to do that you're not able to do anymore? Or is there stuff that you want to be able to do? And I think that that gives us a good idea of like what could go into a cup or what we fill our cup with up on a regular basis.
Yeah, for sure. I love that analogy. You used the word rumination. And for those people that might not be familiar with that word, I'd love for you to expand upon that a little bit. And just in your words, what does this process of rumination mean?
Yeah. If we go back to this idea of getting hooked, that's one of the ways that I like to talk about rumination is that for me, rumination is us getting hooked and then locked into any sort of cognitive pattern, whether the pattern is dealing with the past or the pattern is dealing with the present or the pattern is dealing with future stuff. So if I'm more ruminating about the past, for me, a very common theme that pops up is I ruminate about how I really didn't put a lot of work or effort into things like high school. And if I did, I might be a lot longer on or a lot further on my path than I am now. And then if I'm ruminating about present moment, I might be thinking about or locked into ideas about all of the other things I'd rather be doing than what I'm doing right now. Oh, I'd rather be doing this. I'd rather be doing that. A little tiny side note is I have a client who she gets locked into present moment rumination. Like let's say she's doing the dishes or doing the laundry and she gets locked into this rumination pattern of, I really don't have time for this. I really don't have time for this. And so she's stressing herself out consistently because even while her mind is saying, I don't have time for this, that there are other things I should be doing right now, she still continues to fold the laundry and do the dishes, which I always find really, really interesting, right? She keeps doing the thing, but she's locked in this pattern, this cognitive pattern about there are so many more things that she wants to be doing in that moment. Or if we look at a future rumination scenario that we could be getting locked into ideas about, okay, this is the thing that I need to do next, and then this, and then this, and then this, or this is where I want to go, and then this is where I want to go, and then this is where I want to go. And when you're locked in a rumination pattern, you tend not to do much, especially the future stuff where you might have all of these ideas about what you want to do and where you want to go, but you're so locked up in that cognitive pattern that you don't actually do them. You're just thinking about them all the time.
Right. And I've also heard before other people talk about the symptoms of anxiety being sort of placed in those future ruminations, while the symptoms of depression can often sit in ruminations of the past. Would that be somewhat of an accurate statement?
I'd say generally that's a pretty okay statement. But when I'm working with somebody, I really like the idea and the practice of helping them figure out where their depression or their anxiety exists. So generally we might say that, yeah, anxiety is more towards the future and depression is more towards the past. But I might ask somebody within a mindfulness exercise or post a mindfulness exercise within the work that we do is like, where do you feel your depression comes from or it's going, right? And like, let's say they think about the future, but they get really, really sad about where they are in relation to that future. I might consider that more of a depressive state. Whereas if, let's say somebody is thinking about their genetic lineage and they've got heart disease in their family, that they could have a lot of anxiety thinking about all of the people that they've loved that have died from heart disease and how they might be the next one. So we can't really concretely say that anxiety is future, depression is past, because I think it's, again, contextual and individual.
Yeah, really just dependent upon that particular individual's experience.
Yes.
You use the word mindfulness there, and what I would love for you to expand upon is that point in and of itself, because that's a word that we hear a lot now when people are starting to explore aspects of mental health. And for you, what does mindfulness mean to you?
Yeah, again, just like stress, mindfulness means many things. If we look at more of a general mindfulness, which is kind of how mindfulness is being used today, it's a general term, it's an umbrella term, that underneath it sits ideas about tuning into the present moment, maybe feeling sensations or noticing thoughts, recognizing that you have some options with how you relate to what it is that you're dealing with. So that's one sort of realm of mindfulness, what I call mindfulness general. And then we have a term that's more coming out of the mindfulness literature these days, which is mindfulness proper, which is actually talking about how mindfulness practice traditionally came from a place and from a lineage. So there is a Buddhist lineage of mindfulness practice, usually sits within what's called the insight or the Vipassana tradition. So if anybody's familiar with the term Vipassana, it's a very popular retreat style program that you could go on these days. But the term Vipassana means insight. And so within more of the mindfulness proper traditions, we might look at mindfulness as one, being able to train some kind of consistent attention. So let's say I pick an object like my breath and I do my best to pay attention to it. At some point I get distracted or pulled away and then I come back to it. But then the idea with the attention within mindfulness proper is that we start to build up a base layer of attention to then investigate things from, to really look into things. So if I don't have a stable base layer of attention and I try to look at a thought or an emotion, probably more often than not, I'm just going to get pulled into that thought or I'm going to get pulled into the emotion. And then I really can't observe it or notice what it's like because I'm fully absorbed or encompassed in it. It's kind of consumed me. And so once we build up that base layer of attention, as we start to sort of pivot and turn in any direction that we need to investigate, that base layer of attention allows us some stability to look into the things that we're doing. So that's more of our mindfulness proper kind of idea. But within general mindfulness these days, it's really just like, tune in, what's happening? Where are you? Where do you want to go? How do you want to get there?
So basically just this act of checking in with yourself and being aware of what's going on. It might be something physical, like if you're in pain or discomfort, or it might be something, as you alluded to, an emotion that you're experiencing at that time. Why is that important? Why is it so important to just be in that present moment? I mean, we hear this term, be mindful, be present, but what's the importance of it?
Yeah, also another really good question. The way that I want to frame this is sort of the way that I talk to my clients about what I call noticing practice. And if we look at the sort of the newer Jon Kabat-Zinn definition of mindfulness, it's kind of been broken down these days. It's like just noticing, right? And if you're noticing really, really well, you're going to pick up on a bunch of stuff. But I think the real benefit of being present in the moment is that, and this is the way that I describe it to a lot of my clients and students, is that if you're a human and you're in a body and you have senses, then all day long you're walking, or and you live in an environment, so that has to be part of it, that you're existing in an environment, that as long as you're human, you have senses, you're living in an environment, then you're moving around all day and you're having experiences. We're all having experiences. And when we're walking around all day having these experiences, some of the experiences are very conscious. And a lot of the experiences, I'm going to say, are sort of sub or unconscious. Whereas like an analogy that I might use is like you walk out of the grocery store and all of a sudden you're singing Don't Stop Believing from Journey. You're like, how did that even get in there? And it's because, well, you were consciously paying attention to your grocery list and where everything is in the grocery store, that in the background, your mind is always paying attention to where you are in space, where you are in the general idea of time. And so you're always taking in inputs. You can't, and this is the thing, you can't not take in inputs. You're always taking in inputs. Even while you're sleeping, you're taking in inputs. Even before you were born, you were taking in inputs. And so as we're having experiences, what the mind will start to do is it'll start to label these experiences in one of three ways. Usually it's either a positive experience, a negative experience, or a neutral experience. So yay, no, or meh. And what begins to happen when our mind begins to layer on some of these base layer opinions, those base layer opinions can start to roll out stories. And I like to call these little stories like micro narratives, little tiny like conversations that we have with ourselves. And sometimes we don't even know that we're having conversations with ourselves, but we totally are. And if we don't notice, or we're not mindful of some of the experiences that we're having, these sort of base layer micro narratives or opinions that we have about the experiences that we're having, then what we might not notice is how these micro narratives start to turn into behaviors. And gone unnoticed, we can be pulling out a whole host of behaviors, whether we're talking about thought behaviors or we're talking about physical behaviors that we do. We can have full-blown conversations with people and not really be mindful of what's happening in those conversations. And then I find that with a lot of my clients, when most of these things go unnoticed, what happens is they end up moving in a direction that they either didn't want to go in, or they didn't even notice that they were going in, right? Until after it's done. We're like, oh, I didn't want to yell at my kid there, but I totally did it. And I'm going to say one of the reasons was because there wasn't a lot of mindfulness as to the hooks or the antecedents before the behavior, before the yelling at the kid. And so we just want to be more mindful in general to the fact that we're always having experiences. To a degree, the mind is always layering stuff on top of it, perceptions and perspectives. And gone unnoticed, we end up just getting pulled by the currents of the mind.
Yeah, I have two thoughts that come out of what you just said there. And one of them is, when we talk about the brain and we talk about the brain and performance, one of the very common things that's discussed is flow states, right?
Yeah.
These states where you get into these creative flows, or you talk about professional athletes being in the zone and all of the positive benefits like from that. But it appears that there is just as equal a channel that you can flip and go into this sort of flow state. However, the outcome of the behavior that you're intending is not positive or not something that you enjoy. And I just find that so interesting that you never really necessarily hear it a lot in the way that you just described it. You hear it a lot where I blanked out, right?
Yeah,
and this happened, or, you know, and then I yelled at somebody and I didn't mean to, I was so angry. But it seems like the brain just has these automatic states that it goes into, and some can have, like, as you said, these positive outcomes, and some can have these negative outcomes.
Yeah, I think, and I think that that's a really great recognition, is because especially within the world of athletic performance, we think of flow state as a really, really positive thing. But if we look at, like, let's say the idea of flow states from a positive perspective, is that the flow state really arises via a degree of repetition in anything, right? Like if I just shooting up free throws, eventually there's going to become this point where my body trusts my mind enough and my mind trusts my body enough that they're just communicating with each other. And I really am not even a part of it. Like I'm there and I'm experiencing it, but I don't really have to effort in a way to do that. And so what we're looking at there is just practice. The more that you practice anything, the better you're going to become at it. Like for me, I practice the pattern of deadlifting so that when I need deadlifting in my daily life, I don't have to think about it. I can just bend over and pick up my daughter off the floor. And I can definitely say that I've had this experience after really practicing like good hip hinge patterns. And then I just went to pick up my daughter off the floor and I was like, holy crap, what just happened? Like all of the stuff was there and I didn't think about it. I wasn't worried about my mechanics. I wasn't like, what is my breath doing? I needed to do the thing and I did the thing. But in the opposite end, with more of the negative stuff, if we practice ruminating, we're going to get super solid at ruminating.
Yeah. It's almost like you're practicing, not practicing.
Yeah. And even if we would look at like the world of, I really like a guy named Greg Lehmans. If people don't know who he is, maybe check him out. And like within that sort of realm, whatever it is that we practice, we become better at. And if we practice poor movement patterns, we get poor movement patterns. If I practice negative stuff, that's usually what I tend to roll out is the negative stuff.
Yeah. And I guess when we talk about flow states and performance, the outcome and the behavior is sort of this feeling of elation and success and accomplishment. And when you're not practicing and going through this sort of more negative, if you want to call it a flow state, the outcome again is behavior based. I also find from a lot of people that I've spoken with over the years, and maybe you could speak to this a little bit as well, that people that are in these ruminations, or they're maybe not practicing mindfulness. And as you said, the body is bringing in all of these inputs throughout the day that maybe they're not noticing. And what I find to be a common complaint of people is, and it becomes very difficult for them to understand, is, look, I don't have any stress or anxiety or depression until I get home at 7:30 at night and I've been working all day, and now I'm at home and I'm supposed to be enjoying my dinner, and all of a sudden I feel like my heart's racing or I'm having an anxiety attack, and it doesn't make sense to me because I'm now supposed to be in my safe space. And I guess that would just go back to, again, that accumulation of input that you might not be recognizing as being distressful for you.
Yeah. And I think, like, I like to use the analogy of, for those of us that used to watch The Simpsons quite a bit when we were younger, there's this episode of The Simpsons where Homer ends up putting on a bunch of weight because he wants to work at home. He doesn't want to go into work anymore. And his job is to type YES into the computer to release a little bit of pressure from this big tank that's constantly building pressure, and then it needs to be released. It's building up pressure and it needs to be released. And then at some point he decides to walk away from his desk and he leaves like the little hingy Bobby Bird to just hit the Y button for him. And when that doesn't happen, when that little amount of pressure doesn't get released, the pressure just builds and builds and builds and builds. That's kind of like what I'm getting out of the story that you're telling there, is like there's constantly these inputs, and gone unnoticed or undealt with, depending on the input and the relationship to the input, then all of a sudden it just, the pressure builds and builds and builds, and it doesn't get a time to release until maybe the person is at home eating their wonderful dinner. And then all of a sudden the pressure release valve goes off and the heart rate goes up, or they're ruminating about the day that they had at work when ideally they would be enjoying their meal. And that's what I love about these ideas of just brief check-ins or mindfulness stuff throughout the day, is that for me, the brief mindfulness stuff is just tiny pressure releases, right? Just checking in, releasing some of the inputs, right? Being able to decipher through them, get rid of what I don't need, keep the stuff that I do need.
So what are these check-ins? How does somebody that's never explored this that might be listening, and they're experiencing maybe what I just described, at the end of the day when they get home, they're experiencing a lot of stress or anxiety, or they're getting some of these physical symptoms. What do you mean by check-in? Can you give the listeners out there maybe a few little tools to sort of, or maybe it's just scheduling something in your phone and saying, I'm checking in now. What are your suggestions there?
Yeah, I love what you just said, is that sometimes we actually have to plan check-ins, because for some of us, our days are so busy. Even in the time of COVID, sometimes our lives are just so busy that we don't really take time to tune in and be present with ourselves, right? Maybe we're taking care of kids all day. We're constantly wrapped up in the kids stuff, and we don't check in with how we're feeling. We're just barreling through our lives, arms swinging, head down, and hoping that things work out okay. But sometimes the check-ins can be scheduled. Like, I say that to my students or my clients quite often. It's just like, set a timer on your phone. Maybe it's the same time of day. The cool thing is that with smartphones, you can actually download timers that have like random features where the timer will just go off at any time of the day. My suggestion with that is like, shut off the random timer before you go to bed though, because you don't want to get a mindfulness alarm at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And really, like, when you get these external reminders from your phone, or you give yourself the internal reminders, right? Sometimes that's the way that it's got to be. It's like, oh, I need to check in. And then it can be something as simple as, if it's available, you close your eyes. And if you're in heavy traffic, I'm going to say, don't close your eyes, like keep your eyes open. And the check-in could be a question. How am I feeling right now? Or what am I thinking about right now? Or one of my favorites for my students in like the general mindfulness of things is like, what's happening right now? And then they just start to notice, like, what are my eyes seeing? What are my ears hearing? What is my body feeling? If you're driving your car, it might be like just taking a moment to feel your hands on the steering wheel. Like, what does that feel like? Sometimes these check-ins don't have to be anything but a couple breaths. Like, that's one thing that I say to a lot of my clients and students, is the better that you get at noticing, the less time it takes for you to settle into some sense of presence. Like, nowadays, I can take two-ish breaths and I'm already like, okay, here I am. I'm here right now. And in the beginning, that wasn't always true. In the beginning, especially when I first started to meditate or do meditative practice, I would spend minutes upon minutes of trying to settle into the moment and really like get grounded and present. But that's one of the benefits of a continued practice is, again, back to this flow state idea, is that the more you practice, the better you're going to get at it. And then you could be anywhere doing anything. You could even be in the middle of a conversation and do a brief check-in with yourself. That it doesn't have to be this thing where you sit down in a dark room and close your eyes and put on whale sounds and light some incense. That it can happen anywhere, anytime.
Yeah, I hope everybody listens to what Steve said there. It doesn't have to be in a dark room with whale sounds or dolphin sounds or candles lit. It can just be this act of a simple check-in. One of the things that I've heard from so many patients and friends and colleagues over the years is, number one, I'm not good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, which is the ironic one, because there's some great internet memes on it, is I don't have time for it.
Yeah.
And I think that, and you can elaborate on this as well, is I don't think we're trying to be good at mindfulness, are we? I think we get better if, for example, you are meditating consecutively. And I actually did this last year. I tried to meditate 365 days in a row. That was my...
I remember that.
Yeah. And I failed at 270 something. And the irony of it was I was at a very busy time and I really beat myself up on it.
Yeah, right?
Because it was a good streak. It was my New Year's resolution and I was disappointed. But then I kind of stopped and thought and said, like, there's so much irony here because I'm missing the point. That's not what this is about.
Yeah.
So this sort of trying to be the best at meditation. And for a lot of us that are type A personalities, that is what we try and do. We try and be the best. We're high achievers. And mm-hmm. so we try to be the best at meditation, point number one, and then elaborate on point number two, which is I don't have time to meditate, or I can't eat. The other one is I can't quiet my thoughts. I'm always thinking.
Oh, that's such a great one. Such a great one. Oh, I'm so not good at meditation. Straight off the bat, you can't be bad at meditation because meditation is not a thing to be good or bad at. And in that realm, sometimes, like when I have a student that comes to me and they said, I really just can't meditate or I'm terrible at this. My first question is, what do you think meditation practice is? Because sometimes that's the biggest stumbling block, is they have a perceived idea of what it is and what they're supposed to do and the benefit from it. And then they lock themselves into that idea. And then as soon as it doesn't go in that direction, they're like, either I'm out or I'm terrible at this and I might as well give up. If we consider that, and this is the way that I like to make distinctions sometimes. Actually, I like to make distinctions all the time, is that when we use a term like meditation, and I'm going to use air quotes here, traditionally, meditation was seen as more of a mind state as opposed to a practice. And that mind state is our capacity and our ability sometimes to be fully present for what's happening while it's happening. It's really good to make this distinction because we all have moments in our lives where we are fully present for what's happening when it's happening. Two really, really good examples. One is like a fantastic poop. Like when you're holding in a poop and then you get to let it go, because before the poop, you're like ruminating, like, oh my God, is it going to come out? Is it going to come out? And then as soon as you let the poop go, like, what's the sound of a good poop? You're like, ah, and there's no separation. There's no separation between you, the poop, and the experience of pooping. Right? Another great one, I think, is an orgasm, right? We're before the orgasm, so many thoughts. After the orgasm, so many thoughts. Did they like it? I liked it. Do they want more? I hope they want more. I want more. But while you're having an orgasm, there's just nothing but the experience of the orgasm. And so we have these moments in our lives where we're fully meditative. Although I think the classic idea of being in a meditative state is like zenning out, like everything's calm and focused. And that's just not true, because the idea of a meditative state is that you're just fully present for what's happening. No matter what's happening, you're fully present for it. And I like to make that distinction between that sort of traditional mind state and what I call meditative practice, which is we're kind of practicing to sometimes achieve those mind states, or to allow them to happen more consistently, or to recognize that it's already happening, right? That we actually do have these moments where we're fully integrated and fully connected. But if I use a definition, one of my definitions for meditative practice is that we're trying to train the mind to be present for what's arising in the moment. And that's it. And that's difficult, especially when the mind consistently wants to take us into the past, into the future, in alternate present realities, right?
So it's more about it, especially if you're getting a lot of thoughts that are being generated, it's more about trying to take a step back and observe that thought with some neutrality to it rather than get sucked into it.
Yes, exactly. And when there's this common misconception through lineages and like some miscued information that we have this idea that meditation practice is about not having thoughts or about stopping thoughts. And if that's part of your practice, I wish you the best of luck with not having thoughts. But for the rest of us that are practicing, we just recognize that part of the mind or the brain generates thoughts. It's what it does. As long as there are inputs, there is going to be elaboration on those inputs. And the job within meditation practice is not necessarily not to get sucked in by the elaborations about the inputs, but it's to recognize when we've been sucked in and then to come back to what it is that we're doing, whether we're doing something like breathing or we're listening to sound or sometimes even watching a movie, right? You're watching a movie and you're really into it. And then at some point something happens and your mind pulls away from it and then you come back to it, right? And if we think that thoughts are a problem within meditation practice, then already we've created a stumbling block. We've already created an obstacle to being good at it, because we've labeled this thing that just happens naturally in a human mind as like this enemy that we need to resist. And so sometimes, like, let's say you're going to sit down for 5 minutes and you have this idea that you shouldn't be thinking thoughts. You're going to spend that 5 minutes trying to push all the thoughts away as opposed to what you're supposed to be doing, which is paying attention. And instead, what we do is we find something to pay attention to. We do our best to do that. At some point, we get distracted and then we come back.
So I know there are going to be some people that are listening to the conversation that we just had there about being present and thoughts and not getting sucked into thoughts. And they're going to say something to the effect of, these two people talking are full of it, because because I'm in a lot of pain right now, or I'm going through something. We're obviously not trying to make light of that, but I'm going through something and this is really, really difficult, whether this is something physical, this is something that someone is really, really struggling with, something that is just painful. Mm-hmm. And what is your advice to those circumstances? And it might very well be the same, and just trying to, again, take that portion of the mind and try to practice and repeat along with all of the other things that they're doing or resources that they have available to them, or for those people that are really feeling that pain, is there a different piece of advice, or it always comes back to that same baseline practice of be attentive, be present, try and be non-judgmental? And I guess something that we haven't really talked about yet is compassion as well.
Yeah, which I think is a really important part. And I think as any sort of practitioner working with people in pain, compassion is essential. And not compassion in that you're going to try to get rid of someone's pain. Because like, if we could really get rid of somebody's pain in a very sort of like consistent, precise, specific, immediate way, we'd have already figured it out. Like, it would already be done. But the fact is that pain is a moving target. Like, I love that idea. There's so many variables that go into something like pain, whether we're talking about it being more like from the biopsychosocial model, is it more biological? Is it more mental? Is it more social? And I know these days people are like, well, if it's psycho and it's social, then it's probably not bio, but I don't want to discount some people's bio pain. My knee after 6 years in a factory does not always feel bad because I haven't had enough sleep. Sometimes it's just sore because I got kind of a bum knee.
Right.
But I know how to make it feel a little bit better or a lot better sometimes. But within the realm of, let's say, people working with pain, if we look back at this idea that while we're having an experience, our mind is going to label that experience. And depending on, I'm going to use the C word, which is conditioning. Depending on some of our conditioning, we have different ways of relating to that pain, right? Like if you're a Shaolin monk and you get hit on the back with a piece of bamboo and you're really, really well trained, you still feel it, but it doesn't mean a bunch of stuff, right? That it's just like, you're kind of trained, like, and this is what I like to say about like Shaolin monks. It's not that they're trained not to feel pain. They're trained to relate to their pain differently than most of us are trained to relate to our pain, where they're more accepting and holding of it. Here it is, it's happening, as opposed to trying to push it away or resist it. If we go back to this idea that for most of us, when we have an aversive experience, like physical pain, mental, emotional pain, most of what we're probably trying to do is push it away. I don't like it. I don't want it. I'm going to resist it as much as I possibly can. And then we waste all of our resources trying to push away something that usually doesn't go away simply because we're pushing back on it. And especially if you're talking about mental and emotional pain, the more we resist, the more we push back, the more that pain comes at us, usually harder, stronger, faster, and smarter is what I like to say. The pain just gets smarter. Or like this idea that when you practice being in pain, your pain gets really smart and it figures out how to trick you into feeling pain again.
Would you say that pushing it away would be the same as trying to kind of repress it or ignore it? Would you say those things are the same?
Yeah, I would say that they're pretty much the same kind of thing. I call them avoid, escape, or control strategies, right? I'm usually trying to do one of those three things from more of a habitual standpoint or a non-trained standpoint when aversive experience comes up. But with that, what mindfulness and meditative practice really allows us to do is allows us to be present for the pain. And by that, I'm not saying something, for me, it's silly. It's like when people say, I want you to take your anger and I want you to make it your best friend. And I'm like, I really don't want to make anger my best friend.
Yeah, how do I do that?
Yeah, I don't think you can. But here's, I think that you can get to know it really, really well. You don't necessarily have to like it, but I think it's essential to get to know it. Because especially when you're talking about something like physical or mental, emotional pain, and we get back to this idea about antecedents or hooks, to be able to train us to recognize like, well, when I do this, my pain feels worse. When I do this, my pain feels better. When I do this, I tend to ruminate more, or my anxiety ramps up, or my depression gets worse. And when I do this, my depression lowers a little bit, or my anxiety decreases a little bit. Or if I can hold my pain, if I know that I'm going to be in pain anyway, and this is the thing with persistent pain, if it's going to be there anyway, and pushing it away isn't helping and potentially making it worse, then the opposite of pushing it away is just accepting that it's there. And I want to make another distinction. For me, acceptance is not resignation. Resignation is, this is the way that it's always going to be. Acceptance is, this is the way that it is right now. And I think that that can be a very important tool for a lot of people, is they feel pain, but they don't really know it. And they only know it from the place of feeling it almost like as a bystander, if we could say, right? As opposed to really being present in the moments of pain.
Yeah, that was amazing. There were so many great tidbits of information in that little rant that you did there. I love that.
I tend to rant.
But these are such important topics, I think, and maybe you could expand on this a little bit. Maybe that's what you were getting at too, is this idea of responsibility.
Yes.
And what I've heard or read from other people is, if you're in a difficult circumstance that someone else has caused for you, maybe you were in a relationship and it ended because the other person ended it. Maybe someone stole money off of you. Maybe someone caused you physical pain. Maybe you got in a car accident and, you know, you were hit, a seemingly sort of an innocent bystander in your car or something. I've heard other people speak about this and say something to the effect of, it may not be as a result of something you did per se. I've heard your responsibility to fix it, maybe not fix it. How would you put it? Own it, sit with it.
Own it, manage it, be with it. And I like that. I use that sort of language in session a lot, where I talk about the difference between blame and responsibility. right? Like you might not be to blame for what's happening to you or what you're feeling, but you are responsible for it because nobody else can be responsible for it.
Right. And that sucks, right? Like it does suck when you're like, look, this is the responsibility is left to me to take care of this and manage it. And
yeah,
I really had no part in the creation of this, but yeah, it's really, you know, I can't remember where I heard that from, but when I heard it, I was like, yeah, it does suck to hear that, but it is also sort of true.
Yeah. And cause I'm trying not to be like a but person. I'm like this, and just because you're responsible for it doesn't mean that you don't need help to manage it or work with it. Right. Like if somebody has a lot of complex trauma and they're coming into me and there's a bunch of stuff that's happened in their past that they had no control over, they're not to blame for sure, but they have to take responsibility for the feelings that they have, the thoughts that they think, and the behaviors that roll out from that place. But then it's also important that they seek help with people who can help them take responsibility for what it is that they need to do, whether it's a massage therapist, or it's like a counselor, or like a cognitive behavioral therapist, or anybody for that matter, like a physio.
Yeah, just trying to get good people in your corner to help you out, not taking the burden and the weight of it all on yourself, right? Especially when you're in that place where it is so heavy.
Yeah, and I think that really good practitioners aren't just going to sort of like the old like physio or massage model maybe where you would like do all your stuff and then you would go in basically for like damage control. And then you get all the stuff massaged out or you get the physio to take care of some stuff. And then you just go back out and you start doing all the same stuff that put you into that place, where I think a good practitioner doesn't just help them with their symptoms, but also teaches them strategies on how to work better so that maybe the symptoms can decrease or they get better at handling their symptoms.
Right. Because these things aren't going anywhere, right? Like no. This is life, right? Life mm-hmm. is going to bring upon these circumstances that are creating feelings of depression or anxiety or sadness. And this is the way that it works. And I like what you said there about having these ongoing tools and this common theme of being able to check in on yourself and building up and being sort of resilient to this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of it is even going to be whether it's from a practitioner standpoint, like maybe you can answer this. Have you ever started to use techniques that in the beginning you really weren't quite sure of, but you became more sure of them the more that you were using them?
Yeah, I always say to people, use the techniques that you are really, really good at and you get and you get better at. And
how do you figure out what techniques you're bad at or they don't work?
You do them and you suck at them.
Yes. And I think that that's so key is that, like, we live in a culture or a society that's very much like 100% perfection all the time. No, and even though we're coming at it from the place of like, yeah, failure is fine, failure is okay. But then you go to get a job in a field that you don't have a lot of experience in, and the person's like, well, no, you need more experience because I can't trust you not to make mistakes. You're like, well, how am I ever going to get better at it if you don't let me make some mistakes and figure it out? Exactly. And so I think it's the same whether you're talking about a practitioner and the tools that they're giving, and then even the client and how to apply those tools, and that some of that's going to be trial and error, right? Like if I give my clients whatever kind of exercise to do outside of session, they're probably going to do really good at it in session because I'm guiding them, I'm helping them. But then when they get outside, it's like, they don't have me there being like, well, maybe a little bit this way or a little bit that way. And they kind of mess it up a little bit, but that's also part of the practice is play around with it, get curious, try not to see a failure as a defeat, because I don't think that the two are the same thing. I think we have failures all the time, but we don't need to get defeated. And that we learn through practice and trial and error, right? Like somebody, a blind kid can shoot a free throw a bunch of times in a row by figuring out how not to move in relationship to the sound that they hear when the ball bounces off the rim.
Right. And I think you're right about that there are so many of these tools that are available now that, and as you said before, it doesn't need to be in a dark room with candles and whale sounds, what have you. Simple setting of the phone and checking in might be something that you start with, and then maybe you end up in a dark room with candles and whale sounds.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like maybe you start off with something that's really sparse and all over the place. And maybe the more that you start to enjoy it, or you start to see the benefit in it, you're like, oh, maybe I should do this more and get more benefit. Or maybe I should do this maybe in a different way. If I could touch on that for a moment, there's actually like a term that's arising in some of the literature on mindfulness, which is what we call a mindfulness non-responder, which means that they don't respond well to classic close your eyes, sit down, cross-legged mindfulness stuff. That we have to come at them from a different direction. Doesn't mean we're not doing mindfulness. It just means we're not doing mindfulness or meditation in the way that it's usually seen or done. That we have other ways to do it.
What are they seeing in those people? Just they're not getting benefit from the more traditional styles, or are there other factors or metrics that they're following, or brain stuff that they're looking at?
Yeah. So a lot of what they're looking at in that is more of like outcome measures. Like they like sit down, close your eyes, try to feel your breathing. And maybe sitting down and feeling somebody's breathing is actually a hook or a trigger for them, as opposed to something really relaxing. Like if I have a client specifically who's got a lot of complex trauma. And when I tried to get her to do eyes closed breath meditation, she instantly had a flashback to her trauma. And I was like, okay, maybe this isn't the best place to start for you. Maybe we should start somewhere else. But we're going to do something like that, but we're not going to do it in the way that it's traditionally been done or the way that it's usually taught.
We haven't really touched on this, but what is there a big importance in the breath? Because we hear that a lot in mindfulness, return to the breath, or is it simply just something that's relatively easy to focus on and allow you to return or use as a kind of a home base?
Yeah, I think it can be both. That I think for some people, when we talk about breathing as a way to influence the nervous system, then that kind of breathing can be really, really helpful to help someone downregulate so that they can maybe pay attention for a little bit longer, or they're not so easily like wrapped up or hooked by it, right? Like if I'm in a heightened sympathetic state, my perception is usually more narrow and I'm more likely to get triggered by the stuff around me. Whereas if I can downregulate, maybe via some breath stuff, then when that stuff comes, maybe it doesn't hit me as quickly. Still could hit me, just doesn't hit me as quickly. It's got like a little bit of parasympathetic padding in front of it. But at the same time, what I really love about the breath, because it's a tool that's worked well for me, and I want to like double underline, triple highlight, it's worked well for me. One of the things that I really like about it is that it's always there. It's never not there, which means it's like, I don't need a bell all the time. I don't like, maybe I don't have time to put my headphones on and listen to a guided meditation. I've always got something to bring me back into my body and into the moment.
You don't always have whale sounds, right, Steve?
No, exactly. You don't always have a stick of incense that you can like.
But you always have that breath.
Yeah.
Which is key. Look, I've learned a whole lot during this conversation. I think it's been really, really valuable for a lot of people, but I know that you're on a bit of a schedule, so we'll wrap up. But before we do, I'm wondering if you could provide the audience with maybe one or two suggestions. Maybe they've listened to this discussion and now they're a little bit interested in what we've been talking about, mindfulness or meditative practice, but they really have nowhere to start. Could you leave them with two pieces of maybe skill set tips or even resources that you feel are a great starting point?
For sure. One is, if being more in the present moment is important, recognize that one, there is no such thing as the present moment. That the present moment does not exist as a thing that we can extrapolate away from everything else and say, this is the present moment here, but that's not the present moment over there. Present moment is a concept. And the way that we really connect to the present moment initially is via our senses, right? They are our direct doorway into the present moment. And so any sense will do, right? That it doesn't have to be feeling, breathing, because that's the sense, that's physical sensation. Like that's a sense, but it could be looking at something. It could be tasting something, smelling something, hearing something. Like I really love to get present via sound. Although breathing is really well for me, that sometimes breathing maybe isn't the best tool. And so I have other senses that I can go to. And so I think that that's really helpful, is that if you want to work on just being more present, whether it's a reminder on your phone or whether it's an internal reminder, just take some moments out of the day to be with your senses, like a couple seconds, a couple minutes, just hear something, see something, right? Like that old phrase of like, stop and smell the roses is like, stop and use your nose and pay attention to what your nose is taking in. Or this idea that I really like, and it was sort of like, had an aha moment maybe about a year and a half ago, where I heard somebody say this, the phrase, come to your senses. And I'm like, oh, maybe that's what that actually means, right? Because usually we say it as like, come to your senses, stop acting crazy. But maybe the way that you stop acting like that is to actually come back to your senses, to come back to the inputs.
I like that. I've never really thought of that either.
I didn't think about it either until I heard somebody say it. And I've been doing a lot of like sense stuff in my own practice. I was like, oh, maybe that's what that actually used to mean, was just come back to your inputs. But I think some other helpful tools for people, if they get more interested in practices like this, is there's an app that you can download for Apple or Android phones, and it's called Insight Timer, I-N-S-I-G-H-T Timer. And it's a free app that you can get. And it's a meditation timer. But if you've got Wi-Fi or you want to use up all your data, there are literally thousands of guided meditations on there geared towards a lot of specific things. So whether it's a meditative practice for decreasing symptoms of anxiety or depression, or whether it's a meditation on how to downregulate before sleep, or how to upregulate for something, like keeping that in mind, is that sometimes we don't always want to be super relaxed before we do something. And that being present doesn't mean being like downregulated and relaxed. Like if you're an athlete, if you're Usain Bolt, you don't want to be extremely downregulated to run the 100. Like you want to be upregulated and present. So I think that's a really wonderful tool as well, as like looking towards the app market, which can be really, really helpful.
Yeah. And I'll leave that in the show notes as well, the link for that app. I haven't heard of that app, so I'll be checking it out myself.
I've been using it for a decade, and it's like, it's out of all of the apps that I've tried, it's my favorite, and it's free. Like you can pay for some aspects of it, but it's not like, and no offense to like the Headspace, but if you want to get better through Headspace, you got to pay more money. So it's free.
Yeah. Free apps are always good. Look, where can people find you, Steve, if they want to get more information about the great things that you're doing, as well as your book?
Yeah. So if somebody wanted to pick up the book, they could find it on Amazon. If you're local and you want a door drop off, I can do that too. But on Amazon, again, the book is called Mindful Yoga-Based Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or MYACT is the acronym. So that's where you can find the book. And if anybody does find the book, if they get it and they ever have any questions about it, my email address is in that book and they could always message me. But other than that, on Instagram, I'm at MoveWellFeelGood, which is one word, MoveWellFeelGood. Or if you wanted to find me on Facebook, I'm on there at Steve Farrell Yoga and Ayurveda.
Perfect. Thanks, buddy. I've really enjoyed this. I'm sure we'll do it again. I learned a lot, and I know you're busy, and I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, man. This has been a pleasure.
As always, folks, enjoy your weekend. And I hope that you found this episode to be of value. If you have any questions or comments for Steve or myself, feel free to leave them in the comments section below. And we will see you in the next one.